evening, Alan Shipton is going to continue his survey of the West Coast traditional jazz scene of San Francisco. Tonight, Jazz Notes opens with music by Bob Scobie's Frisco Jazz Band.
Into the 1940s, Lou Watter's original Yerba Buena jazz band had broken up. This is the new group formed by Bob Scobie, whose robust lead playing had been such a feature of the two-trumpet lineup of the Yerba Buena band. Scobie's Frisco jazz band used the tuba as a frontline instrument with string bass in the rhythm section, and this gave his bands a lighter feel than those of his contemporary revivalists. And he also occasionally expanded to a big band, putting his early swing orchestra training to good use, for example on a disc where he backed up Bing Crosby. But Scobie died young in 1963. Up till the point when Bob Scobie left him, Lou Watters himself had always favoured playing second trumpet, but he decided that he'd rather give up the two-trumpet idea altogether once he was left on his own. Only Bob Helm on clarinet remained of the original front line in Watters' 1950 version of the Yerba Buena band.
Say, he's got what I need, I say he has. Now when the blues got me down, jazz comes true. He's the guy that makes me get out both my dancing shoes. Oh, the more I get, the more I want to see. I page old Dr. Jazz in my dream. When troubles are bound and mixed, he's the guy that gets me fixed. Hello, Central, give me Dr. Jazz.
Dr. Jazz, recorded at the club Lou Watters opened in June 1947, Hambone Kelly's. The band members all took their turn in running the club, as clarinetist Bob Helm recalls.
In order to keep the Hambone afloat, we had to do everything. We had an idea that maybe old-time movies, The True Realers, and Charlie Chaplin's and Mack Sennett's and Charlie Chase's, and those would go pretty well. Maybe they would draw a dinner crowd. The biggest problem nightclubs have is getting the happy hour going between 5 and 7 or so, and with dinner to hold a crowd till the band comes on. And so we thought, well, maybe old-time movies would get it. And then the neighborhood crowd would bring in their families, of course, and nobody seemed to understand about Mack Sennett's or Charlie Chaplin's because it wasn't currently popular, and they couldn't figure out the comedy, I guess. And the kids would come in, and I guess the kids liked it a little bit, but the adults were used to that kind of a thing. And they sometimes the dinner was in order to try to get this crowd to not only the movies and the happy hour, they served a dollar steak dinner with a big barbecue pit out there. And so this is where we went before we got on the bandstand. Lou usually made out the menus the night after the job, and then there would be the deliveries the next morning, and then we would get a little sleep, and then he would have to set the dinner up and set up the barbecue pit and get them going, and I would run the movies and set up the bar, and then go out and help him after the regular bartender came on, and then we'd comb the grease out of our hair and jump on the bandstand at 9 o'clock. And it kept afloat for a while, but it never did make it. The families would bring in the kids and order 2 dinners and 5 plates.
Bob, I mean, it always struck me as a slightly unlikely place to start a jazz club in the first place. I mean, El Cerrito is not exactly downtown, and I wondered why that place was chosen.
Well, that was most of the opinions of the people that came into the Dawn Club. So, well, what are you guys doing over in the East Bay? That's a nowhere place. How do you get there? Where's El Cerrito? And if you're going to get there, we'll have to take a Greyhound bus and be on it for 2 hours, which was not too bad time-wise, not too far off. El Cerrito, I understand why Sal Aranz was there. She had a big club called the Hollywood Club, and it started just about the time of World War II broke out.
Bob Helm. And the Hollywood Club was just one of the attractions lined up along the El Cerrito Strip, part of the longest road in the area called San Pablo Avenue. Before it became a proper township, El Cerrito encouraged gambling, dancing and drinking clubs, and there were plenty of other well-known night spots. Singer Pat Yankee worked in some of them.
The first time I heard Turk and Lulu Waters Band, I was about 13 years old, and at the summers I wasn't going to school. I was dancing in a line at the Golden Gate Theater, and this lady that had the line there put a line of girls in it called the Kona Club, which was over at Hambone Kelly's. It was across the street from Hambone Kelly's. And so I was not of age, so I had to sit in the kitchen all the time because I couldn't go out and mingle with anybody. So I used to sneak over to Hambone Kelly's to hear Waters and hear everybody. And they had a sort of a side door and stand there and listen to the music.
Now, Hambone Kelly's was the other side of the water.
Was in El Cerrito.
And quite an extraordinary place by all
accounts. Oh, yes, it seems like everybody had a hand in Hambone Kelly's. Some of the band members, like Bob Helm, they were cooking. He did some of the cooking, and from the stories I get.
And Lou Waters himself was very much a presence there, wasn't he?
Oh, very much so, very, very much so. I was a little bit young for that whole scene, but I loved the music at that time. Just loved it.
Thank you.
part of the Lou Waters Band's 1950 version of Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me, a record produced by someone you'd hardly expect to find in such a staunch bastion of traditionalism as Hambone Kelly's. Bob Helm explains.
Norman Granz, of course, as you know, was all associated with jazz at the Philharmonic, much like some of the jazz shows these days are composed of all soloists. And so he approached Lou about making some records and on the phone, and then he says, well, I'll be out there in San Francisco and I'll come to see you at Hambone's. And so he arranged a meeting, and I was there at the conversation, and Lou says, Norman, you're not associated with this kind of music. What are you doing here? What do you want us to do here? He says, you don't even like this kind of music, do you? And Norman says, well, I'll tell you, Lou. He says, it doesn't sell very well, but it's like a string quartet. It continues to sell, and it enables me to speculate on what's current, what's modern, what's the latest. So this is how I support myself. I think it was a tongue-in-cheek thing, too, but anyway, that's what he told Lou. He says, well, Norman, how many sides do you want us to make? He says, well, 150, 175. This backed Lou off a little bit. He says, what kind of music do you want us to play? He says, what you're playing.
One of Lou Waters' records for Norman Granz, his most famous composition, Emperor Norton's Hunch. On New Year's Eve 1951, Waters closed Hambone Kelly's, driven out by the growing respectability of the El Cerrito area, which clamped down on gambling, drinking and dancing. In due course, Waters himself drifted out of the music, apart from the odd comeback, and it was left to his former sideman, Turk Murphy, to establish a new club, right in the oldest district of San Francisco itself. The place was the brainchild of art dealer Charlie Campbell.
I found a place, the Italian village. It was only a 2 minutes walk away from my shop and where Turk lived. And the basement was empty, and I knew the Italian group that owned the upstairs supper club, where they had people like Ted Lewis and Hoagie Carmichael was there, and the six-girl show. This whole basement was empty. It was a dance floor. A bar, tables, it was terrific. And they said, you can have it. We want to run the bar. We'll give you 10% on the bar. I said, we'll do it. So we got this one concert going in January 1952, and we needed four more musicians. Where'd we find them? In Portland, Oregon. Bob Helm, Monty Ballou, Don Kinch, and Bob Short. And we got them to come down for that one afternoon. People lined up half a block away trying to get in. It was incredible. The management of this upstairs club could not believe it. This joint had been empty for a couple of years down there. Here we are filling it. So a few days later, I talked to him. I said, I want to take it over and run it with Turk Murphy. Sure, okay.
Charlie Campbell. And from those beginnings in 1952, Turk Murphy went on to become an institution in San Francisco nightlife. More about Turk and his band tomorrow night. But one musician central to Turk's style was ragtime pianist Wally Rose. I spoke to the man who took lessons from Wally and who continues his legacy today, Pete Clute.
When he opened with Turk Murphy's band at the Italian Village, I used to go down there every weekend with a friend of mine, and we'd sit behind Wally's piano. And of course, in those days, we drank too much and we were underage. And we got to know Wally really well, and then I brought up the subject again of teaching me how to play ragtime, or just teaching me how to play the piano. And he said, sure, he'd do that. And he gave me lessons. I studied with him, I guess, for a couple of years. If I had any problems with the rags, he'd show me the little tricks and things that he'd do to get around things. And of course, sitting behind his piano every weekend for a couple of years, I learned pretty much how he played with the band.
Wally Rose and Red Pepper Rag. Well, in due course, Wally's pupil, Pete Clute, took over the piano duties in Turk Murphy's band. After the Italian Village Club folded, the band gave up the idea of a permanent home and they went on the road, playing all over the United States and particularly in New York, where in 1956, as Pete Clute explains, things took an unexpected turn.
We met a gal named Mary DuPont. And Mary DuPont was from the DuPont family, and she took a real liking to the band. In fact, the cornet player, or the trumpet player with the band at that time, Larry Conger, eventually married her. She decided that it would be a good idea if the band had a home in San Francisco, but not only that, one in St. Louis and one in Chicago and one in New York. She wanted to do a chain of nightclubs. So you were asking me how it felt to run a nightclub or whatever. Easy Street opened on New Year's Eve of 1957, and at the end of the night, they came up to me and said, okay, Pete, and they had a key in their hand. They said, now you run it, which was kind of shocking in a way, but they gave me an extra $100 a month to do that, and I needed it because I had a child then. You know. So I really cut my teeth on Easy Street and being able to lose the DuPont's money. So that when we opened Earthquake Magoons, I had a pretty fair schooling on how to run a nightclub. but it was always a headache. I had to be there like at 9 in the morning to meet the delivery people for liquor and whatever else was coming in. And I'd run back home for a couple of hours to feed the kids and help out, and then go back. But the playing was really relaxation. That was the fun part of it. So you just put in all the other time because that's the only way you could really get to play the music that you loved.
Karma Queet. Bob Helm on soprano sax with Turk Murphy on trombone and Pete Clute on piano. Very much the kind of music that the band played for relaxation from the pressures of club owning. Earthquake Magoons, named after a comic strip character, became a San Francisco institution. By the early 60s, when it settled into its second home, 630 Clay Street, for 18 years, it was on the agenda for Grey Line bus tours and it was listed in all the city's tourist literature. For jazz lovers, as the band's cornetist Leon Oakley explains, there were added benefits.
The Earthquake Magoons on 630 Clay Street was at the most fabulous jazz club around. If I thought it was good, I knew it was good when I heard people from the world's greatest jazz band, like Yank Lawson, say, this reminds me of those clubs in New York City. You know, Billy Butterfield would also echo those same phrases about the greatness of the club. It was a great sounding club. It was really wonderful. Never found a place that was better than that after that. I know because I played in most of the other places. Even if I wasn't with Turk's band, I didn't like most of the other clubs as well. But it was a wonderful dancing club because it had when you walked in on the first level of Magoons, the bar was on your left as you walked in the door. And then the room spread out towards the center of the room. And then from that point towards the bandstand, you stepped down a few steps, and the dance floor was lower than this area. So you could actually sit, watch the band, listen to the band, and not have dancers, so you couldn't see the bandstand. Now, the bandstand was a relatively high one. And then besides that, if you went up the stairs further, yeah, there's a set of stairs that went up to a mezzanine. And a mezzanine surrounded that area above the dance floor, and you could sit any place up there, listen to the band, watch the band, watch the dancers. It was an ideal place to play, but also, as you can tell, an ideal place for a patron to go who just wanted to hear or dance both to the music. It was there. It was really a perfect setup. Sad thing when they tore that down.
Leon Oakley. Well, not only was the club musically ideal, but just as Hambone Kelly's had lured the punters in with old movies and barbecues, Earthquake Magoons had its own gimmick, the magic cellar, something Pete Clute grew to realize was a real asset.
Turk and I had found the largest collection of magic that there was in the country, and we had all the paraphernalia and trunks and things for people to sit on. It was really funky and old.
And this belonged to some extraordinary magician who...
Yeah, it belonged to a fellow named Carter the Great. And Charles Carter was a partner with Harry Houdini in the Martinka Magic Company around the turn of the century. And Carter made 8 world tours, and he wasn't very well known in the United States, but he was well known throughout the world. People would come with stories about Charles Carter. He was meticulous. He was an attorney, and we had all of his records, and then we had thousands of posters and billboards and things, and we fashioned the magic cellar with all this paraphernalia. And it was really great because the young people, like I say, would come by. And then pretty soon, you know, you watch magic for an hour and a half, you get kind of bored, and they'd hear all this thumping from upstairs. And they'd wonder, what in the world is going on up there? And they'd go upstairs, and they'd hear Turk and the band, and they'd begin to like the music. And then pretty soon the old people upstairs would hear all the young people coming up and wonder what's going on in the basement, and they would go downstairs. So you got a really great mix of all different ages of people and different things for them to do. So they could come at 8 in the evening and stay till 2 in the morning and have a great time. I think that was the only time we ever made any money.
Turk Murphy's band from the Earthquake Magoon days. Tomorrow night, more about Turk when Pat Yankee, Leon Oakley, Pete Clute and John Gill join me to consider his musical legacy.
And Alan Shipton returns at...